You're listening to Star Wars Beyond the Films, the official expanded universe podcast of StarWarsReport.com.
There is a great disturbance in the Force.
Welcome to episode 29 of Star Wars Beyond the Films, your Star Wars discussion podcast. We broadcast on Middle Earth Network Radio, as well as on the Star Wars Report website. Our episodes are also available on our own Facebook page at SW Beyond Films. But enough about how you got here. Let's get this show started. I'm one of your hosts, the defender of the EU, Mark Herleman. And with me, like the Ashla to my Bogan, the EU guru himself, Nathan P. Butler.
Hello, everybody. Awesome. I got to be the light side this time. Yes.
Enough about light and dark. Oh, wait, no. We're going to focus on that, aren't we? That's right. Nathan, tell them what we got coming up.
That's right. Last time you heard us talking about Dawn of the Jedi, we've been to some of the bigger swaths, first impressions, things like that, how it affects, you know, the history of the Star Wars universe. Now we're going to narrow it down into some more specific elements, starting out with some of our characters, because this introduces a whole new generation of a cast of characters, people we have never met before, not even gotten a hint of before, because this is set so far back into the past. So we are on Dawn of the Jedi, essentially part two here, still dealing with Number Zero and Force Storm. Let this be your spoiler warning, because, as we say, here we go.
That's right. The first thing we're going to talk about is the fact that this series sold out in the first two issues. Now, that's issue zero and number one. We had, what, three printings with number one, Nathan?
That's right. We got three printed. Actually, one and zero. They printed the first run of them, right? So we got Dawn of the Jedi Zero. And a couple weeks later, we got number one. And number one had two different covers. It's got the one that's got a lot of the characters and one that's just Zesh on the cover of it. Or essentially just Zesh, who's got his mask on the cover of it. And then they sold those and we're like, hey, holy crap, we just sold out. And they ran a second printing of them. Oh, crap, we sold out. And when they did the third print and they finally realized, holy crap, we got a genuine phenomenon on our hands here. So we wound up with a new Zero issue that has one of the Tho'Yor ships on it. And we have a new one issue, or first issue, which has Zesh in it, but it's like a younger version of him where he's got his mask off and everything. Now that, of course, that big surprise has been revealed partway into, I guess it was the first issue, second issue? Second issue. So yeah, we got multiple printings of it, and that's not even counting the fact, not only do they sell out the print copies that are selling like mad, they've also released these things as digital copies, and they're selling like mad. I would actually say this is the first time I've picked up multiple copies of a Star Wars story for multiple covers without it being something to replace something else, or at least one of the few times I've done that. Usually if I'm going to buy something a second time, it's like the Marvel stuff and I'm getting the omnibus editions because I don't want to mess up my old ones. Or I got something that was, you know, I got the regular cover for Darth Vader and the Lost Command number one, but I wanted that 25th anniversary of Dark Horse one, so I'll replace one with the other. But I'm always buying one and then selling the other one off, or buying one and then storing the other to keep it safe. And this time, just the excitement, I wound up buying both versions of number one with its original cover when it started, and the third printing with the new cover. Same thing with the two different versions, the first and third printings of number zero. And because it takes like a week for these things to get to me through Things from Another World, I've been buying them digitally also. I mean, the only Star Wars comics I've bought digitally are these and my own. My Star Wars Tales 21 with Equals and Opposites in it finally came out digitally through their app. I guess it was like the 28th of June or something like that. So I bought that one because I just wanted to see what it looked like in a digital form. But otherwise, I wasn't like, nope, I can wait. I can wait a week. It's fine. And with these, it's like, nope, can't do it. Can't wait a week. Just got to buy them. And I think that's the general feel amongst the Star Wars community, because these things are being just gobbled up off store shelves.
Yeah. See, and that's one of the things. I too, am a Marvel collector for a long time. I have a Venom Gold cover from Venom the Lethal Protector, even. That was one of my prized possessions at the time. And variants are always a lot of fun. Typically, they do cost you a little bit more. Knight Errant, I believe it was one of the first ones to start redoing the variant comics covers. When that one came out, I was tempted, and I almost did it. But there was a part of me in the back of my head, the little OCD, going, if you buy one, you got to buy them all. And I'm just like, I can't afford to buy them all. Well, you got to do it if you're going to do it. And I had this whole little argument, and I'm like, my hand set it down, and I only walked away with the one with the two Jedi. And I don't think either one of these Jedi are even in the story on the Zero I have, where they're both kind of holding their hands up.
The guy who really needs a shave and the woman who either has a tattoo around her belly button or just took a shot of buckshot to the stomach.
Yeah, it's like, who are these guys? Wait a minute, is that Asha and Bogan? I don't know.
I like the fact that that you can get them digitally. I like the fact that they are celebrating the launch of the new series with multiple covers. But I mean, it is sort of one of those things where once you start, it's hard to stop. It's like Pringles. Once you pop, you can't stop. In my case, I mean, I think I hate the Dark Horse digital app. Okay, the Dark Horse digital comic app sucks. It's slow to load, refreshing takes forever, and half the time it crashes while it's refreshing the storefront. You got to go back in, okay? Don't like it. Comixology's app, where you can get every other comic on the planet except Dark Horse stuff, is far superior to it. But I'm apparently sticking with it for Dawn of the Jedi at this point. I almost gave it up. In fact, I was so frustrated. I guess it was for issue number 5 because issue 5 came out. And they're like, it's on its way from Things from Another World. You'll get it in a week. I'm like, okay, I'm going to get it now. I'm going to get the digital one. So I go to buy the, what is it, $3, $4 digital copy of this thing. And I pull up the store, and for the entire first week of its release, the price tag on Dawn of the Jedi number 5 was a price of ?? It was screwed up. You couldn't buy it. You pressed and said, it's processing. We have an error. Sorry. And I'm like, I'm sending emails to Dark Horse. Can you fix it? Can you fix it? What's going on? Can you fix it? And I'm popping up on their Facebook page. Something's wrong. And they didn't fix it till a week later when the issue had already reached my hands. But you're right. The digital addiction got me. I've been reading through all the Ultimate Marvel stuff. So I'm used to just, you know, I'm going to click the button, and buy some digital comics and read some more. And I happen to pull up the Dark Horse app. I'm like, it's got a price tag now. I wasn't going to pull it up if somebody hadn't said that my comic was finally out on it. I was just going to delete the app. But no, I had to go into it for equals and opposites. And like, oh, number 5's got a price tag. I've already read it, but it's number 5 and I've got the rest. And boom, picked up that thing. So I think I'm still going to stick with the digital first reading for now, which makes this the only Star Wars comic that I'll be doing that for. But you're right, it's variant comics, or however you pick up one issue of these, it's definitely hard to let go. I have to wonder if that's why Star Wars has pretty much ignored the idea of single-issue stories for years for the most part, because you're more likely to get hooked if they've got one to stretch it out to the next issue and the next one and the next one.
Well, that was also why they switched to the art format and went away from the larger number. I mean, yes, they're still technically following each other, but they were afraid that those casual readers wouldn't come into like Spider-Man, which is up at 668 or something like that. Well, I don't want to jump into that boat. It's one of those things where, you know, I see where they were going with it. Another thing that I really enjoy about what we got here, you know, it's a whole new era. And with a whole new era, we have a whole new era logo. And, you know, it's on the front. And it's also the image that we see on those Throw Your ships. Granted, when we first saw those ships, I was thinking, oh, it's the Imperial Cog, which technically, maybe, yeah, if you're looking at it in the right outlook or the right lining, but it's on the Yothor ship, it's like depth to it. There's multiple layers. So, yeah, it could be the Imperial Cog or it could be this new logo. Obviously, it's this new logo, but I like how either one could work there, and that, too, is a reoccurring theme, you know, that kind of cog-like look to it. But those Throw Your ships, man. You know, we didn't really talk about those much in the first episode of this two-part episode. We had 9 of them. One of them was much bigger than the rest. We did mention that it was like Mortis. But when I saw that bigger one, I immediately thought that one had to be Mortis. I don't know why. There's just like, oh, it's Mortis is George Lucas's. So obviously, you know, the big one's got to be George's.
Yeah, I like the fact that you've got the symbol on it. I like the Mortis connection. It'll be interesting to see if they actually make that connection, though my guess is they won't, at least until the Clone Wars is done. They want to leave that to George so they don't wind up doing something and having George come around and poo-poo the idea. Not poo-poo on the idea, but poo-poo as in just saying, no, don't do that. Although, like,
no Mortis for you, poo-poo!
It could go either way. I just wanted to see something where it would have been funny if Zesh, instead of being Zesh, was named perhaps Orek, right? Because what's on these characters' faces, they are Orabesh letters, basically. So, for instance, Trill, the Force Hound that we meet in the first issue that works for Skalnas, she's named Trill, and it looks like she's the Joker, like, why so serious? Until I realized, holy crap, that's a letter. It's not a Joker face and a line going up to her nose. That's the, like, downward arrow-looking letter of the Orabesh alphabet called Trill, and hey, that's her name. And Zesh, holy crap, Zesh is the name of the letter. It would just be funny if it was Aurit, because he looked like Captain America. Had the big old A on his forehead, but I just wanted one of the characters to look at him and nobody asks this. This seems like the most obvious thing to ask to this character when they meet him, or even, you know, in the infirmary at the end of the story arc, something. Just have one of the characters look at him and go, why do you have a letter on your face?
I never even caught that. I mean, holy Sith, you're right.
There's one thing also in the fifth issue, if you look in the letters column, somebody else had caught that. It didn't even strike me at first. Somebody else had caught that, and they make the comment, that's Randy Stradley, the editor, says, actually, if the Force Hounds are all named after letters in the Orabesh alphabet, then there might be as many as 33 others, counting Trill out there. Of course, there could be many, many more than that, perhaps with names unrelated to the alphabet. Though it's kind of interesting to think that there could be a limited number of these simply because of the alphabet. You know, like Alpha Team, Bravo Team. You know, you reach a point where you're like, I have no more letters left to use. But you would think somebody would have said, okay, we get scars, we get tattoos on other parts of the body, but you got a tattoo on your face, or a brand, or whatever it is, and it's a letter. And your name is the name of the letter. That's quaint. You know, you kind of stop to think that maybe they've taken Sesame Street a little bit too far in the Rakatan Society.
Well, obviously, it just shows you how little they care for their slaves. Yeah. I mean,
he's obviously A.
You're not just a number now. You're just a letter.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember growing up, my friend was Jose, and my uncle used to always call me Jose B. I mean, it's just, obviously, sometimes that just happens.
Nice. Well, you know, when I've got students of the same name, when I first am learning their names, it's always, this is like Tanisha 1 and Tanisha 2. Now, granted, I don't say that to them, but at first, you know, I have to learn the difference between the two in their personality and their looks and all that kind of stuff so that I can tell them apart. And just being able to say 1 and 2 reminds me, hey, that's their first name. You know, so I can see, you know, it dehumanizes in this case, but at the same time, you know, it gives them some way to identify, you know, if you're not taking the time to get to know beyond that next level. For me, it's a surface level, and then you get to know them better. And you're like, okay, now I recognize this person as an individual. I don't need to remember a number or something. I remember their last name or their interests or, you know, something about the cadence of the way they speak or something like that. But you can imagine the Rakatans just not giving a crap and saying, okay, I mean, even worse than with, say, the clones in the Clone Wars, okay, well, you know, you're just the letter, go kill. Okay, we don't care about your personality, go kill. But I guess that opens up the door for us to a degree here in dealing with the characters, unless we want to add anything more about the Tho'Yor ships before that.
I think we can come back to the Tho'Yor ships. I mean, we basically know that at least 8 of them, I could be off on this, so it could have been all 9, but I think 8 of them went to locations, and we will be talking about those locations later. But the first character, you know, we mentioned him in the last one, Dagon Lok. I was wrong. I'm looking here at the end of number 3, and again, he has a one-moment scene where he's in the whole last page, and he has one word. The first one, it was darkness. Now we've got power. And, you know, there is a definite build-up there. There's something sinister going on with Dagon. I mean, you know, they gave us a little tiny, itty-bitty, teeny-tiny, microscopic little hints. And I don't know. I mean, you look at his eyes, and when he says power, he's got, like, some Sith eye action going on. Granted, it's not, like, raw and red around the outside, but it's got a whole gold look to it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't trust him.
I don't know. See, I had almost forgotten, and I think I mentioned this last episode, I'd almost forgotten that Zesh's image or whatever, because it wasn't like he was sending the message, but that Dagon Lok had also seen that summoning, that force vision of Zesh, because here I'm thinking at the end, maybe there's hope for Zesh. Probably not much, because of the way he looks at things and you know, how do you meditate on something you don't understand? But at least, you know, maybe there's some hope for the character. But then I realize, oh, crap, Dagon Lok, he still hasn't encountered yet, which means that the Force must be assuming there's something important between those two. They're going to have to cross paths. And if he winds up showing up on Bogan only to wind up running face-to-face with someone in-depth into the dark side, well, here we go. Here comes Zesh falling right back to where he was before. But it makes me wonder, yes, there is a Sith Eye kind of thing going on. Wouldn't it be interesting if, with all the hints we have about darkness is coming, power, finally it is beginning, all these things that sound sinister and ominous, what if Zesh gets there and it turns out that Dagon Loke is basically this generation's Obi-Wan? He's the kindly old man who just doesn't look it. That would be such a twist and throw me for such a loop that I'd love it. I mean, I want to see where it goes either way, but we don't know enough about this guy. Maybe he's meditated long enough that he could go back. He just perhaps chooses not to for some reason. It's an interesting character in that he's almost like a Boba Fettish type character in the sense that we don't know enough about him to be able to say much. I thought Zesh was going to be the Boba Fett style character because he had the helmet on and I figured he was going to keep it on for ages. By the second issue, the helmet's off and we're learning more about him. But maybe Dagon Loke is sort of that kind of character. At least for right now, he's the one that has the potential that we don't really know which direction it's going to take us.
I'm sorry, you had me at Boba Fettish. Now, you know, he's definitely one of those characters where you mentioned, what if he's the Obi-Wan? That would be almost like the opposite of Master Dre in Star Wars Invasion. You know, he was like kind of bumbling, and then we're like, oh, he's a Jedi Master. Oh, wait, no, he's doing something else. I would totally, I think I would be pleasantly surprised if that were to happen. I mean, granted, I honestly think that there's something more sinister involved here just by the look of him, but I think a twist of that nature would be kind of fun. I'd like to see where it would go. I hadn't played it in my mind as to, you know, what was going to happen when Dragon and Zesh get together. I mean, it's obviously these two are going to, and the Rackets and Empire are going to take what we generally would see as the Sith role as the dark side. You know, and this gets into the philosophy thing. You know, we talk about the will of the Force and what does that mean, and is the Force at war with itself? And sometimes, you know, the books and the comics and even the TV shows will kind of give you that hint that, yes, there is a definite hand pushing things in directions. I mean, now we've had Zeshi's crashed onto Tython. He set things in motion. Now he's about to go to Bogan. He's going to run into Dragon. It's like, well, where's this going to go? We've got the Rakutans looking for him. I mean, darkness is mounding all around these poor Jedi Rangers. And it's just like, where is it going to go next?
There was something in issue number 5 that really kind of struck me, because we're so used to thinking of the Force War as this great light side versus dark side conflict. And it will probably be a great light side versus dark side conflict, the way that it's been hinted at in things like, you know, Jedi versus Sith, the essential guide to the Force and such. But I find it interesting that maybe there's an interpretation of this that's a little bit different than what we've been led to believe. Maybe it's a little more complex than that. Because when everything is going crazy with the dark side, because Zesh is there and it's throwing Tython out of balance, and all the lightning is happening, and Jedi Master or Jedi Master Quan Jang is out there trying to get it under control, meditating sort of in link with other Jedi Masters around the planet. He says, or it's said within the narration as he's doing this, that he feels Tython out of balance, skewed to the dark side. The planet itself reacts. The seas churning, the land writhing, the winds tearing at the land. And then it says, the Force is at war with the planet. Which makes me think that maybe the whole Force War thing, it's much more than just light side versus dark side, people versus people. That maybe this literally is the Force, in a sense, at war with itself, thanks to the attunement of Tython to it. That it's very much like what we see within the Mortis episodes. When the daughter dies, everything starts to go out of balance, and it's only going to be able to be brought back into balance by sacrifice, by somehow forcing things right, either by wiping everyone out or whatever new interpretation of balance Lucasfilm or the writers or Lucas wants to come up with. It made me sit back when I saw that Force is at war thing, that there's a lot of things that were sort of taken for granted with this. Dagon Loke, oh, he must be the dark sider, oh, they must represent the dark side in the upcoming story. There's so much we take for granted with this because of what we think we know. But I remember what it was like when we thought that same thing with the prequels. And so many things that we thought we knew were wrong. Yeah. I'm going to try to keep an open mind.
Yeah, that's what you have to do. I mean, the worm, I called it the Dune worm. I believe in issue 4, it starts spitting out lightning. And they were like, whoa, that's new. And then it starts spitting the lightning up into the storm. I mean, there's a lot of crazy things going on in the middle of that fight with that worm. And the main one that I loved was Kresh. He looks at her and he's like, she will run. The Force Hound senses the female's fear, her blood up. Breath rasping in her lungs, four senses on edge, suspended on that thin wire between death and life, intoxicating. The Force Hound is confused, and suddenly she's glowing. You know, and this to me is the Anakin Solo moment in Star by Star, where you know he's just glowing in the Force. I mean, she's literally just blazing.
Except Tahiri is not going to go back in time and kiss her.
Yeah, exactly. And the Force Hound, he's clearly confused. He does not, again, this gets back to, he doesn't know the light side. This is completely throwing him off. The female's fear is suddenly gone. She is not running. She will die protecting the fallen ones, the weak ones. Never in all his journeys, in all his battles, has he seen this, felt this. And then he snaps and he lights his Force blade. He's, death and blood! And jumps off the ledge. But it's like, wow, I mean, it compelled him. And again, you know, we were talking about before our show, before we started recording this two-part episode, about how there was like a connection between him and the two female Jedi. And again, it's like one of those things. It's like there's this unspoken kind of connection and the story drives it. And in a situation where you're like, he should be running, he came back.
That gives us a good opening here to finally actually start talking about Zesh, because this is a character that really stood out to me, and I didn't think he was going to. It's like, oh, he's going to be the brooding Darksider. Oh, yay. Gee, we haven't seen that kind of thing before. Oh, he's the Boba Fett type character. He'll say one or two words, and everybody will be like, ooh, he's so awesome, because he doesn't say much like Darth Maul and like Fett and blah, blah, blah. I was kind of thinking, please don't fall into the stereotype. And you know what? He didn't. He fascinates me by the end of this issue. And I'm the kind of guy who, I don't know, am I in touch with my feminine side? I don't know. But there are certain things that when I see them in stories, it's not that I get choked up. I can feel the wellspring of emotion really kind of hitting me. Like with Quantum Leap, with Dr. Sam Beckett never returned home. When you realize that it's because he's trying to help Al to fix a wrong in Al's own life because he values happiness of his friend more than himself. That, to me, really kind of hits me, and it always gets me every time, no matter how many times I read it. And this kind of did the same thing when I started thinking about who this character is. We spend a lot of time analyzing, and I know we did when we did that Attack of the Clones commentary thing, talking about the background of Anakin Skywalker and all the psychology behind him. This is just an extreme case of the psychological side of this character being such a wellspring of development. And just the revelation that he has here is to me, it's a very emotional type of thing, realizing there is such a thing as honor, life, goodness, whatever. He's about to leave them behind, for instance, and we see the flashbacks. He's fighting in the arena. He's bred to be a killer. He's basically like a clone in the Clone Wars. He's created for this. It's all he knows. He's powerful. He's strong. He's confident. But it's because it's all about death. For him, it's all about darkness. Kill or be killed. You will leave someone behind if they are slowing you down. You will leave someone behind to be bait. You will pull a Vestara, so to speak, if it's what you want by sacrificing somebody else. And if you've read Fate of the Jedi all the way through, you know what I'm talking about. It's that kind of thing. But we see Shay, for instance, activate the Force Saber, and she's about to stab him through. I mean, she grabs it because Master Quan Jang may be dead. He's been injured in the process of trying to shut down the Force Storm, and she's about to stab him through. He says, I expect it. I sought a good death in battle, but this is my fate, so be it. When your people eat my body, you should have the honor portion, my heart. You were very brave. And she just shuts it down, and she's like looking at him like he's nuts, you know. Stranger, that is not our way. And before he passes out, he's got that, you are very odd beings. And yeah, he passes out. But we get this sense with the bit that you talked about and then that bit, that this is a character who has known nothing else, and it's a strange new world for him. To them, he's the strange visitor. To him, their way of life, the idea of anything beyond servitude and darkness is something he has never experienced before, and it's so enlightening. And we get the point where Tasha goes inside his thoughts, and she sees him in the pods with the other people essentially born to be Force Hounds. She sees the Rakatan technology, and you know, she's like, I don't even get it. You know, how can you not feel anything? He's like, well, what I felt when he jumped back in to help them, I couldn't let your light be extinguished, but he can't even put into words the idea that there is an emotion that would go along with that type of feeling. And it really kind of made me feel for him like, wow, this is an amazing step for this character. I want to see where he goes. But then it's a crushing blow, to me at least, when at the end they decide they're going to send him to Boggan. Oh, he's too dangerous. We're going to send him away. And, you know, well, if he goes to Boggan and he meditates on the light side, he meditates on Ashla, well, maybe then someday he can come back. And it's like anything else, you know, it's like when you take the student who is a special education student, but the parent says, no, I want my kid in a regular class because I don't want that label attached to them. So they throw them into the deep end, and the kid is fighting for their lives, doing everything they can, but there's stuff that they need help with and they can't do. They're throwing them into a regular English class when they're dyslexic with no one there to help them learn to read through the dyslexia. And that's what they're doing to this guy. It kills me as a teacher to see them throw him in and say, well, you know, well, he'll just have to meditate on the light side. He doesn't know what that is. He has no concept of it. How do you meditate on something you don't understand and you have no concept of? I mean, it's like asking me to fly.
Yeah, so, culture shock.
The Zesh character felt like such a stereotype at first. I was so worried that he was going to turn into this dull character that's just doing the Boba Fett thing. And now he turns out to be very much like Cade Skywalker. He is one of the few characters in recent Star Wars that really excites me in this sense of I want to see where he goes because the potential is almost limitless for this guy if they play their cards right. He can be the psychological focal point of this whole series.
Well, and continuing where you left off, I mean, when he goes, you're very odd beings, and when he wakes up later, it starts out, it's all black, and he sees one of the Manon, and he sees a knife in his hand at first, and he goes, have you come to claim my heart? And then of course it changes to what it really is. And the guy's talking to him. He's like, no, I'm a healer. And he's like, what is a healer?
Yeah, what's a healer? That line in and of itself is like, oh my God.
Yeah. And then he's all, will you kill me now? And the guy's like, no, child. And he's like, oh, you know, he's like blacks back out. It's like, yeah, he has absolutely no clue, which again gets back to that. What's going to happen next? I mean, when they talk about how they're going to send him off and he goes to Bogdan, again, we have Dragan right there at the end again, mm-hmm. one whole page, and he's just like walking around, and he looks up, and he's like, finally, it has begun. And I'm thinking to myself, what has begun? Is he found a way, like, say, some Sith later in the future, which would be our past, from depending on where you're at in the timeline, I guess, where they were able to see into the future? Is Dragan seeing into the future? Is he, you know, anticipating all this stuff happening? Does he know what's to come? Has he foreseen this? And if so, does that make him very Palpatine-like? Does that then make Zesh or Kresh or however we're going to say him the Darth Vader of this story?
I love the fact that we have so many questions about it. So often there's questions and I'm like, oh, please just give us a freaking answer. Imperial Commando 501st, I'm talking to you. Where it's like, please give us an answer. Please give us some closure. But in this case, it's a great jumping off point. I mean, he makes the comment, you want to get a sense, they always try to find ways to make the enemy evil. And in making the enemy evil, a lot of times you have to do something that's over the top because every threat has to be bigger than the others or else you feel like, meh, I've seen this before. Yeah, the other Sith were tougher to deal with, you know, that kind of thing. And in this case, we're going to talk about the Rakatans, who are essentially the masters of Zesh as a Force Hound. He makes a comment that really to me echoes, and maybe it's just the fact that I've been reading so much Ultimate X-Men in my Ultimate Marvel reading, but Tasha asks, you know, would you be willing to allow me into your mind? And his answer is, you know, why ask permission? I'm defeated. I'm a prisoner. I'm yours to do with as you will. It's this idea that in his perspective, entering someone's mind without permission, if you're a prisoner, is to be expected. And maybe it's just the way that I look at things. I wrote Greater Good's a telepath-based book, so I've had to think through the permutations of that sort of thing. And there's Charles Xavier's admonitions in the Ultimate X-Men stuff. But to me, entering someone's mind without permission as a telepath is tantamount to rape. And to say that this is a culture that from the standpoint of prisoners or anyone else, you know, not only are they violent in their nature, and you would expect them to be violent to their prisoners and make them slaves and so forth, that they're doing genocide, that they're killing, which is sort of like an end to the pain, that this is a society that indiscriminately just mind rape anyone they saw fit. To me, that's worse than any kind of killing, because it leaves a living victim scarred by it, and they can do it again and again and again. The Rakatans never struck me as this great enemy force. You know, they had the Star Forge. Yeah, that was cool. But they look kind of goofy, and we don't really see a whole lot about them other than the holograms and stuff like that. Now, the sheer evil of the Rakatans and the structure of their society really jumps out at me. And it's all thanks to, you know, one line coming from Zesh in this. They're doing a lot of good layering of the world building here, again, through dialogue rather than all just heavy-handed narration like we got at the beginning of the first issue.
Well, and it gets back to, you know, in the last episode where we talked about the bubbles. You had an inner bubble and the outer bubble. And the outer bubble with the Rakatan Empire, we see how evil they were. I mean, yeah, we got glimpses in KOTOR about how they were powering their stuff with Force-sensitive beings and how they ended up losing their connection to the Force. The Force itself kind of Force-sucked them. Now we kind of see why. And again, it gets back to that whole, okay, the will of the Force. I mean, is this battle going to be the deciding factor as to why they end up losing their connection to the Force? Is it going to be something that's more set in the metaphysical, or is it going to be something set in reality in the Star Wars universe? I mean, is it going to be something that somebody activates or something like that? I mean, you don't know. And with the Rakatan's technology, anything is possible.
And it brings two things to mind, I guess, before we jump to the other one that's sort of barely touched by darkness, but we see her touched a little bit by darkness, brings two things to mind for me. On the 9/11 documentary by the Naudé brothers, the actual footage from Ground Zero where they're traveling with the firefighters, one of those things that every American needs to see at least once, 9/11, I think it's called the commemorative edition when you find the DVD of it. But in that, one of the firefighters from 9/11 who survived says that what he realizes that day is how evil evil can be. And that jumped out at me, and I think, you know, it makes the Rakatans much more evil to see the kind of things that they're doing. But then it struck me going, well, wait a second, if that's how evil evil can be, then how do they compare to the Sith? At which point my mind went, just kind of train of thought literally here in 30 seconds here, was, oh crap, you know, is it that the Rakatans are utilizing the dark side within their technology because they have a natural affinity for that because they are evil? They are evil so they can use the dark side? Or is it that they're using the dark side as their technology has made them evil? Yet another of these chicken and egg situations in this saga that'll be interesting to see if they were to explore it.
So are you suggesting then that because the Sith species themselves as a whole is not in the inner bubble in Tython, where there are a few, but because the majority of the species that was left behind is out in the Rakatan bubble, that maybe that influenced the evil that they later become? Because we do know that their Sith Empire was based in the dark side as well. And perhaps, is that what you're coming at?
Well, sort of. But remember, a lot of their, I mean, they were using the Force magic alchemy type stuff, almost like a Witches of Dathomir thing.
Yeah.
And then the exiles, the people who were part of one of the great schisms, wind up getting kicked out of the Jedi Order, get kicked out of the Galactic proper, in a sense, and wind up finding the Sith and become the Dark Lords of the Sith. I mean, that's what Dark Lords of the Sith was meant to mean. The non-Sith who are ruling over the Sith, and then they kind of had the interbreeding and stuff.
Had a powerful empire at that point. They couldn't even stand a foot against those Dark Jedi.
And it just makes me wonder, though, was it an empire that was actually based in the dark side per se? I mean, was it that they were dabbling in it? But again, it goes back to the chicken and the egg. Was it that they were somewhat leaning toward the dark side because they were using conquest and expansion? Or was it that the dark side that they were using kind of pushed them towards the expansion? I mean, which is influencing which? Is it their actions influencing the Force, or which side of the Force they are using? Or is it that the side of the Force that they're trying to use is what's influencing their actions, which I guess is almost like a Jason Solo type of thing. But speaking of the whole thing about dark side versus light, most of these characters here seem very balanced for the most part. I gotta say that the character that, you know, her attitude bothered me the first couple issues until I really got into the, oh, it's because her parents were killed, was the character of Shay Coda, the Dathomiri woman in here. The only one, as you've mentioned, who's able to use the Force saber, and it's only when she's drawing upon the dark side, only when she is angry and out of balance. Nobody else can use it. Heck, even at the end, they've got masters trying to find a way to turn it on, and nobody else can turn it on, only her. It seems like we've got at least one character leaning toward the dark side here, and while I don't seem to know a whole lot, I mean, we don't know much about the character. At this point, it seems like, oh, her parents died. Gee, wow, we haven't seen that happen before in a story to make someone have a tilt toward the dark side. But the fact that we've got her there as tilting toward the dark side already, I think that's a welcome addition here.
it's definitely like a balance of her character. I mean, she's not, you know, gone to the dark side per se, but more her parents' death has thrown her out of balance. And that gets back into that reboot feel of this set era. I mean, balance, as we've always known it, does not exist. I mean, what is a question of balance when you don't exactly have the same quiet sides? I mean, they're not... The Ashla and the Bogan in this case are just light and dark. They don't really tell you what that means. And we just apply what we know already, which in this case could mean absolutely nothing. I mean, that's what I love about an era like this. And for me, I think that's one of the things about Shay's character is that she's not so much tipped maybe towards the dark side, but she's starting to fall out of balance. And I think that by making her parents deaf, I think it gives you a logical out for that. You know, it's one of those things like, well, maybe she's going to slip, maybe she won't. You know, it could go either direction. Going back to Dragon real fast, you know, I mentioned how in the last of the arc, it's him and he says, finally, it has begun. When I read that and I see him, I don't know. Every time I see it and I look at the look and it zooms in on him and he says, finally, it has begun, I just keep thinking of Yoda and the Clone Wars begun. The Clone Wars have. And I'm just thinking, you know, we talked about how this could be the kickoff of the original schism. And I go back to, okay, is he seeing into the future? And is he pulling a Yoda-esque thing? You know, does he know that the Force schism is going to happen? And it makes me come back to where he is going to fit into this. I really, really want to know. It's just one of those things. But another good thing about this last panel here is you get your ancient writings. And I love how each of these comics has their own letter to the editor, and they all have their own in theme with that era thing. You know, this one's ancient writings and the next one's something else. And the Dark Times got their dark newsletter, whatever it is. I can't off the top of my head think of. But we've already got a picture of the next cover of the second arc. And on it, we have Trill, and she's standing in front of either the Rockets and Overlord or hers or whatever. But her Force Saber is slightly curved. Not much, but just a little. Kind of got some Dooku action on the hilt. I don't know. Some about it, it jumps out at me. And I think about, okay, what all did we get in this first arc? Well, it was all about Zesh. And now what's going to happen? I mean, maybe in this next one, it's all going to be about her. I think just the possibilities when it comes to these comic arcs and where they go are dang near limitless. I mean, because it comes at you so rapid pace and yet so over a period of time that they can build in these little nuances. It's one of the reasons why, even though I can be struggling when it comes to a book, when a comic comes out, I turn and burn right through that sucker. It is just one of my cake and butters right now.
You know, we've talked about the need for more strong female characters. We had a whole episode on the need for more strong female characters. And it's interesting that aside from Zesh, it seems like the characters that really have a chance to go either direction, light or dark, being on the protagonist or antagonist side, perhaps is the best way to put it for the way the story is going to play out, tend to be the women. Because Sekhnos is pretty straightforward, but we've got Shay Coda, of course, who seems like she's at least somewhat tapping in more towards the dark side, because she's one of the only people, her and Zesh and Trill, who we see wielding a Force Saber. But you've also got Tasha Ryo, or Ryo, and she's the niece of, what's his name, Hawk Ryo. So she's the niece of another Jedi that we see, or Jedi that we see here. And we know also that her grandfather was killed during the Despot War. Her eldest uncle was killed during the Despot War, and her father is now Baron Ryo, Volnos Ryo, on that planet whose name I have a hard time pronouncing, the criminal planet, basically, their version of like a Nar Shaddaa or a Nal Hutta-type place. And here she is in the first issue. He's trying to get her to come back. Her mother's a Jedi. Her father is now a crime lord. And he's like, you know, you have responsibilities to your family, to the family business, not to the Jedi Order, to your family business. So he's trying to get her to come back, to forsake what she's learning. And he asks her, you know, to come back. But her response is, no, she can't. And he quips something along the lines of, you know, well, your mother's got a hold of you or something like that. And she's like, no, it's the Force. So she's someone who seems like she's trying to follow her own path because it's like the Force is calling her to be what she is. But with a mother who is a Jedi, and we do at one point, whenever she's in danger, see the mother kind of whisper her name like, oh no, my daughter's in trouble, and a father trying to pull her towards the criminal side of things, and the fact that at one point Shay is referring to Tasha as the woman whose family followed the despot who killed Shay's parents. There's all these different angles pulling on the Tasha character, and they call her the princess, and you can sort of see how she has that. At one point she's a warrior, at another point she's griping about how when she went through the marsh or whatever, her dress or whatever you want to call it, it got all muddy. She's got so many different angles to her that it seems like, even though at this point it almost felt like she was a secondary character to Sekhnos and Shay, at least during the course of the battle, it seems like she perhaps is one of the most dynamic ones that we're going to get to see pulled in multiple directions. And again, that means we're getting another strong female character with more dynamics to her than, oh, well, let's make her sexy. Or, oh, well, she is going to be the love interest of so-and-so, and that's what makes her important. Here's someone whose position could make her important no matter which direction she's pulled.
You know, they say don't ever judge a character or a book by its cover. And in cases like Pong Krell, you know, you have to agree. Sometimes you just see a character and they just look really cool. You know, going back to issue number 0 and then our guide to Dawn of the Jedi, we have the character Tem Madog. You know, you had mentioned Madog Steel. He is the temple master of Rutep, or Teep. The Cathar Jedi is the master weapons maker. His skill in forging blades is uncharted among the Jedi. It is Ben claimed that nothing can break Mad Dog Steel. And the character, you know, he just looks hardcore. He kind of reminds me of the William Wallace of Star Wars here. And all we got is this one pencil out drawing, and I'm immediately like, ooh, that's a character I want to know more about. And granted, you know, like I say, Pong Krell, you know, just because a character looks cool doesn't mean he's going to be cool. And you mentioned Tasha, and that's another character that when they brought up the whole criminal aspect and the way that all played out, I had feelings of Quinlan Voss and his backstory in the EU. I mean, granted, it's nothing that parallels too deeply, but there was, you know, something along the same lines there where there was a need for him to come back to the Clan Voss and this, that, and the other thing. And I like that that conflicts her. You know, one of the things about everybody that saw the vision of Zesh was that they all have a touch of imbalance / darkness to them. To a degree. I mean, not every one of them is big. It's there. And I have to wonder, again, if this is going to play into something down the road.
Yeah, these characters have a long way to go as far as growth goes. Because, I mean, right now, the primary characters, at least in this story arc, tend to be journeyers. You know, they start as a Padawan, then they become a journeyer, which is kind of like a knight, I guess. Then they become a ranger, which again is kind of like a knight. And there's master and the temple master. So you have these different levels, and you've got the Jedi term in and of itself, essentially meaning a mystic balance. G meaning mystic and Dai meaning balance. So you've got this whole new nomenclature to go with. And
Dai meaning center, right, actually.
In the process of creating this, though, it's interesting because they've not only given us new terms, they've created more levels within the Jedi structure, which means these characters, you know, if we're going to see an arc that propels them to the next rank and the next promotion, well, now they can do that more times because now there's more levels for them to jump through. They've got a lot of things that they've built into the structure of this new era that give us the potential to see them grow and grow and grow. Some of the characters, you know, like Sekhnos, he's sort of the Han Solo, the Lando Calrissian character, the hello ladies, look what I can do type of character. But you got to wonder at what point he's going to lose some of that and become more serious. I see him almost as the Jedi version of, like I said, a Han or a Lando, at least by the way that he's showing off and the women are fawning over him all the time as far as this goes. And we've got good development for him. I don't think he's as developed at this point as the other ones. The other ones, for the most part, seem that they had a lot more layers to them than him. But then again, you know, not every character needs some kind of shady background to make it work. Otherwise, you might sit back and say, what kind of society is this where everybody's shady? One last thing, before we move past Tasha entirely, I do have to say, I was impressed by the fact that Tasha is a female Jedi. She is a strong starting point character for the series and a strong female character in her own right so far that can be developed in many different ways, and she's wearing frickin' clothes. She's not wearing something skimpy. There's no boob window. She's not wearing a midriff. She's not having parts of her clothing torn off in battle. If anything, she's more dressed than virtually any other character in the story, which really stands out to me that this is a character that they want you to, I would think, they want you to respect based on her character rather than something sexual. None of the characters in this story seem overly sexualized anyway, except maybe Zesh when they got him with the shirt off all the time. But
Shay had the butt window.
Yeah, well, that's true. Shay did have sort of the weird butt thing going on where she's got, like, shorts underneath pants with, like, bits cut out. But it doesn't seem like they were really pushing the sexual aspect of any of the characters. Even with Kate Skywalker, there was that bad boy sexualization at times. And certainly Darth Talon, right there from the beginning, was the over-sexualized Twi'lek character. Here's a Twi'lek wearing clothes who happens to be female and Jedi. She's breaking every stereotype. Maybe they didn't make weird bikinis back then yet.
Hey, Darth Talon, I'm wearing my Vader pants. Come on over.
More now, machine than man, but that's something we really don't want to delve into.
You know, you mentioned the different levels of attainment for these new Jedi. And the one that I liked the most right away was the Ranger. You know, we actually had an order of Rangers in the EU. You know, they weren't Force sensitive. They worked with the Jedi.
The Antarian Rangers.
Yes. They were mentioned, I believe, in I, Jedi once or twice in a couple other books.
And let me say, you're going to hear it come back in Mercy Kill.
Really? Interesting. And that's one of those things. I like that because it kind of seems like, it's like, oh, that's where they got their name. Obviously, it's a throwback to that. And it makes sense why they work so highly and closely with the Jedi when they did.
Go, go, Jedi Rangers! Nobody?
Use your Force Ever Rangers!
I was going to say, somebody out there's got to remember the old Saban original Power Rangers.
Hup-singa! Hup-singa!
Quick, everyone jump into the air and just kind of head toward the camera. We know that you're actually somehow jumping and kicking someone in the head, even though they're not anywhere in the shot, and people don't really jump like that.
Now, you know, we're going to talk about the planet Tython and some of the locations on here, but one of the things I found interesting about this, well, there's two, actually. Or you could say three. They're called significant places on Tython. One was the Rift. I'm not going to go into much on that. You have to look it up on yourself. But the Old City. The Old City was already abandoned when the Titans first showed up. Legend says that there is a working hypergate there, but it has never been found. That perplexes me, intrigues me, makes me want to know more. And the other one was the Silent Desert. All sound dies here because of some undiscovered element of the sand on the surface. Rocky strata underneath the sand insulates the caverns below from the effect. And there's a lot going on this planet. You know, you'd mentioned like maybe it's the center of everything that's going on with the Force, but there's definitely some things going on. And now we've got all these different temple locations. We've got these caches. And each one's got one of these Thoyors parked over it. And you got to wonder what the connection there is. I mean, granted, you got the whole Mortis aspect of, okay, well, some crazy stuff went down inside that temple. So, you know, it's like obviously anything could happen inside the temple. But what's going on outside the temple? And let's go ahead and start looking at these. We'll just, you know, if you happen to have number one, you can follow along. We'll just start at the first of these and kind of work our way back.
Let me toss out a theory. It's also a theory about the planet Tython. We're so used in Star Wars to them doing the whole, it's all about family lines, right? We see the same family name show up over and over again. There's already people out there speculating, oh, Zesh is going to wind up being an ancestor to the Skywalkers or something like that, which I don't see happening. I think it'd be kind of cheesy if it did. But wouldn't it be cool if they took the whole idea of family lines and said that the reason why Tython is so powerful, Tython is the parent of Mortis, and Mortis was the parent of Zonama Seacott. Anybody? No? That sounds like such a horrible idea. Please don't use that, writers, if you hear that. Stranger stuff has happened. Living planets. We've seen a few of really bizarre planets.
You know, actually, that does not stretch my imagination.
That's why Ryloth can in some cases be said to be tidally locked, and in other cases that it's actually spinning because it's actually alive. It's like their stepchild, and sometimes it just gets angry and spins, and sometimes it pouts.
Oh, snap of a lightsaber. That was actually, I could see that.
Be the essential now, guide to BS right there.
Yeah. Now, it says, around every Thoyor, a temple was found. Each one specializing in some aspect of the study of the Force.
Is it found or founded? Because I didn't remember catching it. Was it found or founded?
You're right. It is founded.
Okay, so they made it once they landed. Because as soon as you said the Old City thing, I was thinking, I wonder how much of these structures were there before they ever got there. But so they made the temples, but the Thoyor, we don't know who made those of the Old City, right?
Yep, that is
okay.
Right.
Okay, making sure I was clear.
Okay, so going back to the Thoyor part, it actually says, Warrior scientists, philosophers, priests, and artisans from many worlds were brought to the planet Tython in the Deep Core. Once on Tython, the ships orbited a ninth larger Thoyor and, after a time, dispersed to various regions on the planets. So they moved out after bringing everyone there, and then they, the settlers, built these temples around them. And I say around them, but basically it looks like they're floating above all of them. I don't think any of them are actually on the ground. They're all out of reach.
There's images in one of the issues, I forget, that it looked like one of them was like buried in the snow or something. But yeah, most of the shots we actually see on Tython, for the most part, they're floating over it. You got to hope that those things don't ever run out of power. The sky is falling.
The Duracell batteries are dropping. We need Energizer quick.
Someone get Jaxton a drum.
Yeah. Our first one is Kaleth, the Temple of Knowledge. And it is perched over a Force Nexus. It's kind of cool to know that they're there already. Kaleth is where the Jedi gather as a whole when important matters arise. It is here that decisions are made and judgments rendered on behalf of the entire Jedi Order. So this is like the Coruscant of the planet, wouldn't you say?
Seems like, yeah, it's like their capital, if you want to call it a capital. I mean, I guess they've got a government on Tython. It doesn't even seem like there's really much of a government structure there. But yeah, it's their center, whatever you want to call it.
It's their throne room on the Academy. Next one, we've got the Bodai, the Temple of the Arts. And I like how this one, I don't know, to me it struck me as very Orient kind of feel. It's got like a courtyard, looks like a cross almost. I don't know. It reminds me of an Oriental movie I saw where they were learning calligraphy and it was in a structure kind of a lot like this. I mean, obviously, it's one of those art mimicking life kind of things. Located on verdant plains near pleasant forests, Bodai is where students and masters study the Force as manifested through the arts. Writing, calligraphy, hey, go figure, dancing, drawing, sculpture, cooking, music, and theater. The temple master of Bodai is Jake Fenn.
That very, Star Wars name, Jake.
Yeah, you gotta love it, Jake. And actually, I know some people named Fenn, too, because my son's Cubmasters are the fans.
Oh, there you go. It's kind of like Luke, It's parrot, right? It sounds Star Wars-y, but still relatable.
That's right. Next, and this is one of my favorite of all of them. I think I want to know more about this one than most. Anil Kesh, the Temple of Science. Here, Jedi Science... I'm getting back to Jedi again, huh? Here, Jedi scientists delve into science and alchemy. The emphasis is on the theoretical, but the results are often practical and sometimes unpredictable. Anil Kesh straddles the chasm, a gorge so deep that no one has ever found the bottom. Probably because there's a lack of technology that can really explore the planet here.
Now, if anybody ever fell in, I bet they found the bottom, they just didn't report it back.
Yes, exactly. Something within the chasm interferes with Jedi senses. The stronger in the Force you are and the deeper you go, the worse the interference becomes. That's got me pondering some things. Some Jedi have gone mad trying to learn the chasm's secrets. To the Jedi scientists of Anil Kesh, the chasm represents the Force at its most mysterious. And they will never cease to try to plumb its depths through science and the Force.
And it looks like Unicron from above. That's right. We also have Mahara Kesh, the Temple of Healing, where, of course, we end the story with Zesh briefly. It's located in the deep ocean, and portions of it are extending actually underwater. Here, the focus is on the healing arts, both with and without the Force. Laser cannons were added to the temple during the Despot War, that place where Shay's parents got killed. A mated Selkath couple, Nero and Kala, are the temple masters, it would appear. So we have a temple devoted to healing, very Jedi-like, it's the kind of stuff we would expect. We have Vertep, T-E-P-E, like Vlad Tepes, known as the Forge. Now, this temple lies directly over an active volcano. Watch out! An interior dome built over the lava sea utilizes the heat of the magma to power the temple. The emphasis of study in Vertep is on the practical, and how the Force can be made to manifest physically. The saying here is, whatever Anil Kesh can imagine, Vertep can make real. Sounds very much like Rakatan technology to me, honestly.
Yeah, Starforge, the Forge.
We have Kigon Kesh, the Temple of Force Skills, where we first, I believe, meet Seknos, located within the Silent Desert. The relative silence here aids the Jedi in honing their abilities in mental and sensory uses of the Force. That's the one that is actually controlled or overseen by the Temple Master, who is, I believe, the grandmother of Seknos.
Yep, that's right.
We have Stav, S-T-A-V, Stav Kesh, the Temple of Martial Arts, very Asian in its implications. Here the Jedi study and hone their abilities in the martial arts and physical force skills, such as the vigorous form called Alchaka, which some of the Jedi jokingly claim was invented just to keep warm at Stav Kesh. Weapons training is also taught here, as Stav Kesh works in harmony with Vertep by testing new weaponry. Adai Bindu, La Mi, is the temple master at Stav Kesh, assisted by Master Tave, a Nogri. That's right, from the Clone Trilogy.
Nice. Up next, we have Padawan Kesh, the Jedi Academy. Hey, gotta love it. At this temple, very young initiatives who are strong in the Force are housed and taught until they are ready to be taken as Padawans by their Jedi masters. The Wookiee Ruhr is the temple master of Padawan Kesh. Next up after that one is Akar Kesh, the Temple of Balance. Above this towering pinnacle floats the largest of the pyramid ships, the original Tho-Yor on Tython. The open-air temple that sits atop the pinnacle is valued as a place for introspective contemplation. Here, the balancing of the light and dark sides of the Force is taught. The temple master is Ketu, considered one of the most accomplished of the Jedi masters.
Also known for Jedi base jumping, because holy crap, that thing is tall.
That's right. Now, these little locations, they're definitely one of those things where they're all shrouded with mystery. Maybe it's the fact that we don't know anything about these Tho-Yors, and I want to know more.
That's right, and in a sense, that's really what we got with the entire series. A lot of mysteries to be uncovered, but I guess as you can probably get from our enthusiasm here, we're very excited to see where this series is going to go. It's all mysteries we want to see unraveled, and they can take their time because it looks like this is going to be a really, really good comic series. From, of course, the team that brought us Legacy, which is my favorite Star Wars comic series of all time, so I'm not surprised to see them really hitting a home run with this.
Yes, unfortunately, you're going to have to wait until November for the next part of the arc. That is your one downside of it. I would highly recommend going out and getting this sucker while it's still fresh and new. Join up, get on the ride, and have some fun with us. Now, remember, you can find our show at www.starwarsreport.com, as well as on our Facebook page, iTunes, Zune, and airing on Middle Earth Network Radio. If you liked our show, be sure to drop us a review on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, or just fire off an email. You can email us at BeyondTheFilms@StarWarsFanWorks.com or SWBeyondFilms@StarWarsFanWorks.com. And be sure to interact with us on Facebook and Twitter. That's at SWBeyondFilms. So, once again, this has been Mark Herleman.
And Nathan Butler.
With Whistler, of course. Thanking you once again for joining us.
And may the Force be with you.
And don't quote us the odds.
Well, they can. We're just not going to listen.
Don't tattoo letters on your face.
I just got effed.